to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 653. I'm here in studio in Grays Lake, Illinois. Again, my name is Camden Busey, and I have with me Dr. Lane Tipton, who is a fellow of biblical and systematic theology here at Reformed Forum. Welcome to the studio, Lane.
Camden, it's great to be in studio.
You can't beat it. We've reconfigured a few things, so the setting looks a little different from the way it normally does when I'm recording here by myself, but it's been a delight to have you for the last couple of days. We've been recording a course, so very soon we should be able to release the first of a whole series of courses on the theology and apologetics of Cornelius Van Til, so very much in line with Voss, and in fact, Lane lectured on Van Til's influence of Voss, that his redemptive historical theology will end up being expanded into an entire course at some point. But you nailed eight really significant and meaty lessons, each one in the ballpark of about 40 minutes. Yeah. So now it's my task to edit it all.
Oh, it was so much fun. Doing the teaching in studio turned out to be a particular delight for me. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. And to get to revisit some of the foundational structures of Van Til's theology and see the way that he really is in so many different ways fleshing out the biblical and systematic theology that he learned from Voss and mm-hmm. others in the Reformed tradition. It was a unqualified delight for me.
I'm so excited about it. I loved being here for the class just to listen to it as a student myself, but now the opportunity to work through the footage and put that all together. I've got about 6 terabytes of information to work through. on the video, different angles and whatnot, and hope to have that edited. I'm going to get to it as soon as I finish editing the videos for the introduction to covenant theology class. All that has been shot, and about a third of the videos are up for that. We have, I think, 43 lessons. They're in the ballpark of 5 to 10 minutes each, and that's an introductory level course, truly for high schoolers and adults who have very little, if no experience with Reformed theology or covenantal theological terms at all.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And I'm excited about that. Looking forward to more and more people being able to take that. That course is entirely free. This course and the whole series of study.
I look forward to hearing that.
Yeah. You can. I'll send you the links. Yeah. And the Van Til course, the videos will be made available online at reformedforum.org. You can head over to the Academy tab, and when you do that, you'll see a list of all of the courses we have available. People can register for a free account, and as soon as those courses are up and published, you can register or enroll in those courses and follow along, and it'll keep track of your progress. And not only will there be videos, but in due time, we develop course materials, suggested readings, quizzes, all sorts of other things fit in there for people to learn and to study on their own time. The goal here at Reformed Forum, our mission is to assist the church in her charge to present every person mature in Christ. And one way that we can do that is by producing and distributing Reformed theological resources. And we've been doing that through podcasts and posts and live events for many years. But now we're trying to move into a new area, not forsaking what we've already done, but including and supplementing that with structured learning, not to present degree options or anything of that sort. Perhaps someday some of those courses could be used in someone else's degree program. That'd warm my heart. But allowing for people who, in their evenings or even, whenever they have free time to watch a lecture, take a course, read assigned readings and learn and grow and deepen in their knowledge of Christ crucified and raised for sinners.
That's wonderful. That's exciting. Exciting development.
I'm ecstatic about it, and I couldn't be happier with the way the course on Van Til turned out, the way it looks. It's tremendous. So stay tuned for that. Take a look on the website and subscribe to the email list, and I'll keep everybody updated through that. But today, to get down to our subject matter for this particular episode, you can head on over to Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. And we've been working through this for 4+ years, and now we come to page 235. We're going to be speaking about monotheism. We're in a section on the content of the prophetic revelation under the larger heading of revelation during, in the time period of the prophets. So we're more than halfway through the book.
We are smoking.
Smoking.
What a torrid pace.
Speaking of smoking, I should have a caveat that if something physiologically strange happens to me in this episode, it's the side effects from some particularly potent hot sauce I ate last night called Da Bomb Beyond Insanity, and it lives up to its name. I'm a fan of the YouTube show Hot Ones, which is a ridiculous talk show in which they eat, the host and the guest eat 10 very spicy wings in increasing spiciness. And the number 8 sauce is always a sauce called Da Bomb, and it's 135,600 on the Scoville unit scale. And I've noticed after watching, you know, a dozen episodes or so or more, it's Da Bomb that always sends people over the edge.
It's appropriately named.
So a curious fellow like myself says, I want to see what that's like. And so I did. And it lives up to its name. And I must say, all the celebrities who eat it and are interviewed and have very dramatic reactions are not acting.
My only regret of that is I did not get it on video. Oh, it was something.
So I'm here. I'm intact. But if I have to go take a break, or if I fall out of my chair or something like that, it's, you can blame it on Da Bomb. So let's get back to the matter at hand, some serious stuff. You know, we've been actually camping out on pages 234 to 235 for a couple months. And it's rich, where we've been speaking about the nature and attributes of Jehovah. But we've mentioned monotheism at points, but now, you know, set the stage for us, the table for us, as we come here to today's conversation.
Yeah, I woke up very early this morning and was a little tired until I started reading this. Mm-hmm. And reading it afresh, there's a depth dimension here that I hope our listeners will appreciate the patience we're taking to unpack this. What Voss is doing here in the content of the prophetic revelation is focusing, especially down at the bottom of page 235, just before monotheism, on the religious reaction in Isaiah to his investiture as a prophet, to his calling up into the glory presence of God in his heaven temple. And Voss says, and we need to spend just a bit more time on this, he spends time talking about the peculiarly fundamental character of Isaiah's religious reaction. Now, we need to put that in context in order to appreciate and understand something, that we need to remember that this epoch of prophetic revelation was inaugurated, remember, with Samuel at the time of the rise of the theocracy. And there's a fundamental contrast that we must never lose sight of between the vision and calling of the prophet on the one side and the sad and lamentable vision and calling and function of kings like Saul on the other hand. And it really is a tale of two registers, right? And Isaiah is peculiar because at the time point that the kings in the earthly theocracy are turning from the Lord, idolatry is running rampant, and judgment is coming upon God's people, Isaiah is given this inaugural vision of God in Isaiah 6, which fixes his attention preeminently on heaven and lifts his eyes above everything that is in dissolution upon the earth. There's a fundamental contrast then that starts to emerge here between what Isaiah is lifted up and enabled to see in heaven and all of the turmoil, dissolution, and judgment that's obtaining on earth under the oversight of kings who fundamentally or by and large are leaders in the corruption that's undoing the theocracy. And so in Isaiah, what we find, and this is what we've got to appreciate here, in the rising to a high point here of monotheism, what we're going to see in Isaiah, and especially his religious reaction to what he sees, is the striking of the chord that is going to characterize the escalation of prophetism driving us toward the coming of the Messiah. Because the center of gravity, Voss is so clear on this, the center of gravity among these prophets, paramount in Isaiah, is not preoccupation with the impending judgment or the coming terrors of the Lord that are going to lay bare this earthly theocracy, but a vision of the transcendent glory of the Lord seated in heaven and the encircling of those angelic hosts who worship him. That's going to be the vision that sets the tone for the species of monotheism Voss wants us to understand. And so if we could, Camden, Isaiah 6, 1 through 7, if we could read that, and then if we could just spend a little bit of time revisiting the unique features that Voss says are of, and when someone of Voss's character and magnitude says this, we really need to pay careful attention to it, the peculiarly fundamental character of Isaiah's religious reaction here, and spend some time reflecting on the 3 points as the context for what he's going to develop about monotheism. I think it will transform our understanding of what's so unique and distinctive about monotheism in this developmental and eschatologically significant movement mm-hmm. in prophetism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Isaiah 6, 1 through 7. It says, "In the Lord that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had 6 wings, with 2 he covered his face, and with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. And one called to another, and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth and said, Behold, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for."
Here's what the Voss says. There are 3 characteristics, 3 qualities that are of peculiar fundamental importance here. And we hinted at them toward the end of our discussion last time. I think they bear a little bit more development here. First is there's a vivid perception of the infinite majesty of Jehovah. Now, think about this. Isaiah sees the glory of the Lord himself in the heavenly temple. And if you take, and this might be debatable, but I don't think it is, what are the 2 high points of Old Testament religion? I think the first one is Moses being taken up on Mount Sinai, enveloped in the glory cloud, living in the presence of God, and being shown the pattern on the mountain for the earthly tabernacle. There is a seeing of a heavenly pattern. And that pattern is the archetypal heavenly template after which the tabernacle is to be constructed. Moses saw that. It's a unique high point in the Old Testament. Isaiah, the thing that stands out is not simply that he sees a heavenly temple, he does. Not merely that he sees the seraphim worshiping in that temple, but he says explicitly that my eyes have seen the Lord. And so there is joined to this conception of monotheism, not simply belief in one God, not a bare or more or less abstract confession of belief in one living and true God, but the eyes of Isaiah behold that glory, and it is that glory, that majesty, that infuses this monotheism with what we might call, instead of just a bare ethical concern, an eschatological concern. Because Isaiah is seeing, for the first time, the glory of the Lord himself in his heavenly temple. And it is that vision, that inaugural vision, that's going to cast its shadow over the sum total of Isaiah's ministry, and as Voss says, makes him preeminently the prophet of the highest religion. And so when you see that and appreciate that, it is not, communicating this might be difficult, but tell me what you think. It's not heaven itself per se. It's not the throne of God per se. It is the splendor and majesty and holiness, in the language that Voss uses, of Jehovah himself, of the Lord himself, that stamps this monotheism with its vitality. And so, having seen that, when his eyes pass back down to what he sees transpiring on earth within the theocracy, I think it's that vision that gives him such an unshakable confidence and such a zeal to proclaim the word of the Lord to a people who have eyes that do not see and ears that do not hear and minds that do not understand. And so I think we have to do justice to the fact that when Voss says there's a vivid perception of the infinite majesty of Jehovah, he means that in the strongest and most realistic sense of the term. There is a rending of the barrier that divides earth from heaven and a seeing of the glory of the Lord that leaves an impress on this stage of prophecy and this iteration or this expression of monotheism that I think we miss if we're just thinking about monotheism just a belief in one God.
Yeah, I think just to orient ourselves or remind us and our listeners and viewers, again, Voss is so keen to point us to what he calls in his dogmatics the deeper Protestant conception, which is that phrase we love so much. And all that means, in a nutshell, for Voss, is that human beings were created with a goal and an end in mind, and they were created for fellowship with God. That fellowship existed in the Garden of Eden when Adam was created, but even there was a greater, higher, more consummate life held out for him through the covenant of works. The covenant of works, you know, Adam broke it and fell into a state of sin and misery. But now it's offered to us and secured for us through Jesus Christ, who brings us to the ultimate consummate life we are to have in the first place. But also, now speaking in conversation with critical scholars and liberals who hold to an ethical monotheism, or some who reject that there is monotheism in the Bible, some who say monotheism came up as a form of evolution. It evolved, that the prophets and later prophets and then the people after the prophets on into the New Testament came to subscribe to monotheism, but they didn't. Israel did not originally. But then with the liberals who might hold to the fact that they recast the whole doctrine of monotheism after the exile, because they had to get rid of all the old views because they no longer had any pragmatic significance or purpose, and had to reorient their religion around something that would be more useful for them and meaningful for them now that they were in exile. Finally, there can be even, I imagine, in certain even perhaps more conservative circles, where monotheism ends up being a static thing, where God is just this abstract, powerful being, or this big God theology, but doesn't necessarily have too much practical input in our life, or there's no direct fellowship other than we respond to the idea of a big God and then live that out somehow. So what we see with Isaiah is he is given a vision of the Lord in all of his glory, and this is a personal God. It's a tri-personal God. He is a tri-personal God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which in a way kind of totally reorients him or emboldens him or gives him a clearer picture of his life purpose, and so that he goes forth at now as a prophet or a messenger of that personal God who desires to enter into greater union and communion and fellowship with his covenant people.
So it's not as if there's just some abstract power or some power of the universe that we call God, even if there is one God. He's not just out there. But now he has revealed himself to us, to his people, and he has done so in a personal way, and he enters into a relationship with his people that works itself out in and through covenant history without in any way, shape, or form compromising God's eternal character, his immutability, his transcendence.
Yes, and the movement toward entrance into that personal, glorious, heavenly presence. Mm-hmm. But the second place, he says, this has for its correlate a deep realization of the immeasurable distance between the majesty of Jehovah and the creaturehood, as well as the sinfulness of man. Now, this is something that I think Voss is telling us in correspondence to the fullness of the revelation. Mm-hmm. And the movement from the earthly type into the heavenly archetype. There, and this is must be appreciated, there's a corresponding awareness of the infinite transcendence and majesty of Jehovah and the creatureliness and sinfulness of man. And think of this, the majesty of Jehovah, of the Lord, is reflected by the wings of the seraphim. And this is telling us something that has to be appropriate to our self-understanding as creatures when we approach God. With two wings, they cover their feet. With two, they cover their face. With two, they fly. And as they do so, their mouths are devoted exclusively to the worship of God. And that is the proper approach of the creature. They cannot behold God without having veiled faces. Their feet are covered to symbolize their creatureliness in the presence of God. But their mouths are given over to the constant and uninterrupted worship of the Lord. Now, set that in contrast to what is happening at that moment in the theocracy, in the people to whom Isaiah is going to be sent. What are they doing? With their mouths, they are speaking words of corruption. They are giving praise and worship to idols. As we'll see later, they're trying to use those idols to manipulate them in order to maintain their political power and prestige. They are fundamentally misusing their mouths by worshiping and serving the creature. And so when Isaiah sees this, what does he do? The mouths of the seraphim worshiping God cause him instantly to what? Cover his own and identify himself as not only personally unclean, but being from a people whose mouths on earth are being used in a way that is absolutely antithetical to the purpose of the mouths that inhabit heaven. And so the point here is that this monotheism has a fundamental piety-shaping function. And the contrast between the mouths of the corrupt kings to whom Isaiah is going to go, whether they are outside of Israel or inside of Israel, and the mouth of the prophet, it deserves all of the accent that we can give it. The mouth of the prophet is to be what? Conformed as perfectly as possible to the mouths that are in heaven, worshiping God and speaking of his glory. And so when Isaiah talks about that deep realization of the immeasurable distance between the majesty of Jehovah and the creaturehood and sinfulness of man, this plays to your point, Camden.
Yeah.
It's not this ethical monotheism is not just a shibboleth for people to affirm as proper doctrine, but it's something that is to be, it is to consume, as it were, the mouths and hearts of those who know the Lord and who serve him. And Isaiah then becomes not merely a prophet who is speaking of heavenly things and communicating the glory that is in heaven, but his mouth is now formed to the mouths in heaven. And so it's as the kingdom of God is going to come on earth, it is going to come in the way that it exists in heaven, with mouths that are devoted not to maintaining some kind of political and social hegemony per se, focused on alliances with corrupt nations for the preservation and promotion of corrupt political ventures. But it's going to be a mouth that is speaking out of the purity of that which is in heaven. And I think we can miss that. It's very easy for us to miss the dynamic transformation that overtakes Isaiah the instant he sees that glory.
I'm thinking also just the effect of the Lord's revelation on other prophets as well. When you mentioned the conformity of Isaiah's mouth to the message and the worship of the Lord, you know, I couldn't help but also but think of Jeremiah in chapter 1 of Jeremiah, where the Lord places his word within him. And it's complete conformity, not in a way that, that overtakes. Jeremiah is not possessed in the way that, you know, we see demons in the Bible possessing humans, but in a way that fully utilizes or uses his own personality and experience, yet he has the word of the Lord implanted within him to go deliver that to the people.
Yes, and it really is a coming from heaven to earth of that worship that is distinctive and what the Lord is after. And third, and briefly here, the unqualified service to the divine glory. Now, after receiving the cleansing that comes from the heavenly altar, after Isaiah pronounces that curse upon himself, the seraphim fly forth with a coal from the altar. Sin is forgiven, guilt is forgiven, sin is atoned for. And in verse 8, he hears the voice that shakes the foundation of the heavenly temple. Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? And he is going to be sent. This is what's so important, I think, beginning in verse 8 and moving into the rest of the chapter. He's going to be sent to a people who have eyes but cannot see, ears but cannot hear, minds but cannot understand. And for a prophet, that can be absolutely devastating, right? Because you're surrounded by a people who ought to know the glory of the Lord, ought to be zealous for his glory and his name, ought to be tearing down idols and speaking against them. Yet, Isaiah's ministry is in a time where that is exponentially accelerating all around him. And the Lord tells him, very similar to Jeremiah, tells him that you are to go and speak my words to these people. And they will be a people who are marked by obstinacy and rebellion, and who, if I could put it this way, to put it in its broader perspective, everyone is going to be predominantly Saul-like. They're going to be grasping for this kingdom on earth to be prosperous and fruitful, to serve the purposes of man, to make alliances with nations for the preservation of wealth and comfort and influence and affluence. And the message of the prophet is going to cut so strongly against the grain of that, that the only thing that sustains the prophet is to know that the end toward which the prophet strains is the unfading glory of Jehovah in his heavenly temple. And it's only that heavenly glory that really gives the prophet what he needs, I think, to sustain him in the face of a people who are pervasively idolatrous. And I think it's very relevant, particularly when we find ourselves in a context where conditions quite similar to the dissolution of the theocracy are predominating around us.
It's so significant. It reminds me of Paul's exhortation in Colossians 3, 1 through 4, where we are to set our minds on the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father, because our life is there with him. And just it's useful, as you suggest or allude to, for us to put ourselves in Isaiah's sandals for a moment, just to think about just the impossible life he was called to live. His calling was not, a cushy job and whatnot. It would have been horrible, but at the same time, glorious, because he was called to be the prophet of the Lord. And no matter what may be going on in our social circumstances or surrounding environment, we must turn our eyes upon Jesus. And that song I played so many times in youth group, right? And the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. That's entirely true, that as we behold the glory of God, it not only should help us put things in perspective, but it also enlivens us. It's life that as we behold God and commune with him, then we are sustained, but not just given the bare minimum we need to survive, but we are given life abundantly.
Yes, he and I think in the context of Isaiah's call as a prophet, what we're seeing here is that he knows that the divine power is not only coming in judgment on the earth, but will deliver those who trust in the Lord into that splendor and glory in heaven.
Amen.
And so this sets up perfectly a theology of monotheism, because as you move into monotheism, pages 235, 238, what is one of the central points of the affirmation of monotheism? It's this. It's that the idols not only lack reality, but the idols on earth are absolutely powerless to deliver A, from the coming judgment, and to deliver B, into that heavenly place Isaiah saw, where all is at peace and all is at rest in the presence of the triune God, in the presence of the Messiah who will descend and ascend. So as you move on to page 235 into 236, he says, when he's talking about these explicit statements that the divinity of the pagan gods is denied, here's what Voss brings out. It's not just that their divinity is denied, but their divinity is denied in the sense that they have no power to deliver, because they have no fundamental existence. They are as powerless as the rocks and the dust from which they are formed. And so that first point there on page 235, Camden, he's saying that tell me if you think this is what's so useful here, that the monotheism that's being affirmed is a monotheism that stabilizes all who look to the Lord in a time of coming judgment, that has as its ultimate goal deliverance from that judgment into that heavenly place that Isaiah saw.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's a text, Camden, I wonder if we could read it, he's quoting from Isaiah 2.
It's one of my favorite chapters.
Oh, it's just something. Isaiah 2, and I think 2:6 through 10 is one of those texts that he quotes, and the accent falls so much on the majesty and power of the Lord, and by contrast, once you see the Lord, you recognize instantly that the idols are absolutely vacuous of power to deliver.
Yeah. I think it's worth mentioning that Isaiah 2 starts with this wonderful consummate vision of the mountain of the Lord, which is important, that, you know, who shall ascend the mountain of the Lord? Well, after Adam, Adam was called to in obedience, but now after Adam, we need a second and a last Adam, Jesus Christ. He's the one, but then the people are seen in the new heavens and the new earth. You can compare this also with the visions we see in chapter 65, where you end up seeing what this future reality will be like, but it is focused upon the worship of the Lord and communion, face-to-face communion with the risen and ascended Christ on the mountain of the Lord. So at verse 6 now, we have this section on the day of the Lord, Isaiah 2, starting at 6. For you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of things from the east and of fortune tellers like the Philistines, and they strike hands with the children of foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. So man is humbled, and each one is brought low. Do not forgive them. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of men shall be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. That's through verse 11.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. See, now here's what Voss is saying in light of a text like this. The wealth accumulated by striking hands with children of the foreigners makes the land, if you just did an empirical survey, what would you see? You would see silver and gold, no end to treasures, horses, no end to chariots. And so from an outward assessment, it appears that there is abundance and prosperity flowing like a river. Mm-hmm. But amidst that outward prosperity, there is such a proliferation of idolatry that just as the land is filled with these treasures, so in a corresponding way, the land is filled with idols. And the idols are not simply the carved images per se, but it's the sum total of what people take credit for their own hands making. And this is such
very Nebuchadnezzar-esque.
Yes, it is so much that way.
Look at all of the things I've done.
look at it. And so here's what Voss is saying. It's so within the logic of idolatry, and within the way the idols were used, particularly at the time that Isaiah is writing, these idols are being sought in order to secure and maintain that outward prosperity, because that outward prosperity in the minds of many was a sign of faithfulness. If you have a lot of money, if you have a lot of goods, if you have a lot of chariots, what does it mean? It means that we're being faithful. But the whole point is that fidelity has given way to idolatry, and everything within the theocracy is making the theocracy as a thing for itself, a thing in itself and a thing for itself. And in a Saul-like way, there is an attempt to maintain affluence, gain influence, and have all of the signs of outward prosperity. But like the Pharisees, what is it? On the inside, it's full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. And so what happens? The land being filled with idols, bowing down to the work of their hands, man is humbled, each one is brought low. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust before the terror of the Lord. So that, what is that? Well, think of it. What are idols often carved from?
Yeah.
They're carved from rocks or trees. They're made from the things that grow from the ground. And so those who trust in them are going to be what? Driven into their mute and vacuous existence. Mm-hmm. Right? Driven into the rocks, driven into the dust as the Lord comes in judgment, so that they're being sent as far away from the heavenly glory of the Lord and into those very things that comprise the idols as their judgment, in a serpent-like way, licking the dust and entering into the rocks that their own hands have worshiped.
Which, again, just drives home the contrast that now we're saved not by the man of dust, but by the man of heaven. So as humans also were created of the dust, koikos, dusty men, you know, that's how the Lord created Adam, directly forming him from the earth. Nevertheless, that's not the eschatology of the image. The image is going somewhere, not to return to the dust ultimately, but to be raised to heaven in resurrection. Yes. spirit, capital S spirit, which also doesn't, that doesn't mean immaterial, but in body soul unity, we are to become spiritual glorious, living in a spiritual glorious mode with the Lord in heavenly places.
So rather than being driven into the dust and into the rocks, away from the presence of God,
this
saving movement is the reversal in resurrection. That's beautiful.
And not just the reversal, but the transcendent is the consummation of it.
Amen. Amen. And secondly, we could read other texts. Isaiah 10 would be a wonderful one, but he also says this, and this is what I think we need to focus on as we trail toward the end of this section. Secondly, he talks about what's so perverse about image worship. And he says that I think most of our listeners, if they're not trained by Voss, they're going to think of an idol as a mere visible representation of some invisible deity somewhere. And that somehow it's just evil to do that.
Like a portrait.
Yeah,
something.
Like, well, you know, what's so bad about that? Well, here's what Voss says. We've already hit this back on pages 135 through 137, but here's what Voss reminds of. When you're talking about the worship of images, Voss reminds us that image worship is a form of magic. And here's the interior logic of worshiping images, whether they're images carved like creatures, or whether they're images of so-called of Jehovah himself. The logic of image worship is that the image and the deity represented by the image or contained in the image is put by manipulation to the use and service of man. So that if you're worshiping idols within the theocracy, your use of those images is to secure your own political advantage, to secure your own monetary prosperity, to secure a human agenda so that the great reversal of religion is bound up with the worship of an image, because rather than man existing for and serving the glory and purpose of God, image worship makes that God subserve the purpose and pursue the end of man. It's precisely the great reversal of religion. So it's not simply that making the image violates the fact that God is intrinsically invisible and not to be pictured, but it is, as Voss reminds, to the pagan magically divine presence of the image, that conception, the image and the God that is represented by or contained in that image is the servant of the worshiper.
Yeah, the worshiper controls the deity, much like a genie in the lamp.
Yeah,
you know, the one who has the lamp kind of controls him to a degree. The use of the actual image is in service of the person. It's a key to control God. Yeah.
Which isn't that, Camden? Don't you think that's kind of a microcosm of the direction of the theocracy under ungodly kings? Isn't it? They are magic-like in the sense that all of the resources that they have been given are being put to a use of extending their control and their hegemony, and the worship is being directed away from God and to idols for the purpose of securing things that only God himself can provide.
Yeah. And then it ends up in Ezekiel, I think it's 34, about the shepherds, the shepherd leaders, and they end up, the bad shepherd eats the sheep. And that leadership, rather than the way that the king was supposed to live in Deuteronomy 17 and 18, the king was supposed to be an expert in God's law and be a servant leader to lead the people in the worship of the Lord. But the false kings, they're not false kings, and the bad kings, false worshipers who are invested with the office of Israelite or Judahite king, they are not serving the Lord in that way, but use the kingdom for their own ends, which in turn ends up destroying the people. They end up eating the people proverbially, and then the people end up eating the people literally.
Yes.
in the exile.
That's so true. So Voss's point here is I think a very useful one. On the last page on 238, he talks about the fact that on the critical theory, you've got some kind of gradually developing monotheism in the era of the prophets. And Voss is saying that really what you have is something much more consistent than some uneven, gradually developing form of monotheism. And I think one of the reasons that is the case is because the prophets are uniformly about promoting the true religion and are not first and foremost being subject to some kind of evolutionary development of religion, but are being controlled by the self-revelation of the God of Israel enthroned in the midst of the seraphim, whose word is placed on the lips and directs the ministry of the prophets to their appointed end, which is to herald the majesty and the glory of Jehovah, and to do so in the face of intensifying apostasy and idolatry, and to do so even as the foundations of the earthly theocracy are being shaken from under their feet. And so I think what Voss is doing here is that instead of the quote-unquote ethical monotheism of the liberals, I think it's better to term this something like a full-blooded eschatological monotheism that is now being so thoroughly theocentric, so thoroughly heaven-centered, that this really is the first and clearest striking of the chord of the religion that you find in the coming of Jesus.
Yeah, and Voss is reiterating at the top of 238 that, as you said, it is consistent. So if this evolved as a process, as a practice, as many critical scholars would say, then you would expect that you would see some sort of a difference between the earlier and the later prophets, that the earlier prophets would have a much less developed conception of monotheism that would eventually grow in among the people of Israel and to a fuller, more specific form in the latter prophets. But Voss is saying, no, this is something that's the very heart and core of religion from the very beginning. And while there's a progressive revelation, and he's certainly not any form of a staticist or anything, there is a deeper Protestant conception. There's the heart of this matter from beginning to end, that God, the one true and living God, exists and is bringing his people into union and communion with him in heavenly places.
Right. And the intensification of this monotheistic principle in Isaiah probably deserves all the emphasis we can give it, because the great prophetic era has really reached, in the Old Testament, has really reached its virtual high point in Isaiah. And this provides the confidence that the prophets have that this judgment that is coming upon the earthly theocracy is a necessary phase of judgment en route to the realization of what Voss will call in other places the ideal or heavenly kingdom itself, that place where Jehovah's glory dwells enthroned among the angels. And so I think here, as we talk about monotheism and as we move on to consider the attributes of Jehovah, keeping that in view, keeping in view the concrete function of monotheism, as you pointed out, is really going to prove useful, because we're now into a thoroughgoing intensification of the true religion that's going to reach its acme or climax in the coming of Christ, his ascension into heaven, his pouring out of the Spirit, and his bringing a people into that place that Isaiah saw to behold the glory not only of the promised Christ, but of the ascended one.
And just as was mentioned earlier, you know, one of the pinnacles of Old Testament would have been Moses seeing the Lord on the mountain and having these things revealed to him, and he receives the pattern and and type of earthly things he is to construct and build, which are to, meant to be in service of directing our attention and our worship toward the heavenly places. But what do we see in the Gospels? Matthew 17, I believe, you see the Transfiguration, where Peter, James, and John are on a mountain with the Lord, and he's transfigured before them, and in a sense, kind of the veil is pulled aside just a little bit, so they see his more of his, you know, eternal heavenly glory, who appears? Moses and Elijah with him, and the Lord, a little bit of an anticipation of their future life that we will have in Isaiah 2 and Micah 4 with the Lord on the mountain. They got a little foretaste of that. And so that's where the religion is driving. The worship of the Lord is moving in that direction, and that's not something that has sprung up over time. It's moved organically and developed. It's been progressively revealed to us in fuller form, but the kernel has always been the same from page one of the Bible. Yeah. Well, wonderful. So that works us through all the way up to 238. Now we can work on next month getting into the nature and attributes of Jehovah, omnipotence, Jehovah of hosts, here in Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. Get a copy if you don't have one already. Very soon, we're also going to try to talk about Voss's book, Grace and Glory. At least a new edition of that has been published by Banner of Truth Trust, and we're very thankful for that. So we've got to work on scheduling something on that in the very future, near future. But check out Banner of Truth in the meantime. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.